The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 272, Swimming Upstream into America, a discussion of Armand Moss's The Angel and the Beehive, the Mormon struggle with assimilation.
Pardon, you're just going to sit back there? All right. Could we please take seats so that we can begin this session? I'm Kendall White, and what we'll do is follow the format that appears here in your schedule. This is the session examining Armand Moss's new volume, The Angel and the Beehive, Mormonism's Struggle with Assimilation. And I will simply introduce those of us who are on the panel, and then after we do our various presentations, we can assume our seats and then give Armand his chance to respond. I'm a member of the sociology department at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, and I'm quite pleased to have this opportunity to be able to participate in this assessment of Armand's book. Jan Shipps, whom probably all of us know, or at least certainly most of us, a very prominent scholar of Mormonism, whose book Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition, is, we could say, a modern classic. And I see from some of the kinds of things that she's been doing over the course of the past year that she's probably got almost another book for us. And after Jan speaks, then David Knowlton, whom we are probably also quite familiar with as well, former professor of anthropology or assistant professor of anthropology at Brigham Young University, and now at least for a while at Colorado College. Is there? This may... Is it up? Closer to my mouth, I won't even be able to see the text. Okay. With that, then, I will begin my comments. For both committed Latter-day Saints and scholars interested in Mormonism as an historical, social, and religious phenomenon, there's much to recommend in Armand Moss's book, The Angel and the Beehive, The Mormon Struggle with Assimilation. The argument bolstering his retrenchment hypothesis will provide even those familiar with Armand's previously published research and his array of secondary scholarship with a fresh and intriguing interpretation of the Mormon experience. Based upon a reformulation, or perhaps a more pristine conceptualization, of the classic Weber-Trolz church sect theory, Armand argues that religious movements, as sects or cults, initially confront their host society as a threat or challenge. In response, the host society attempts either to domesticate or destroy the religious movement. While domestication entails the loss of the most distinctive beliefs, behaviors, and rituals, as the movement is assimilated into the host society, transformed, if you will, into a church, destruction of the movement depends upon the host society's successful use of discrediting techniques, persecution, or repression. Since the logical extreme of both strategies of domestication and destruction is the end of the movement, either its loss of anything unique through absorption into society or its demise through coercion, religious movements have a vested interest in developing strategies which enable them to maintain a dynamic tension between themselves and society. Optimum tension maintains sufficient distinctiveness to preserve the group's identity, encourages retention of existing members and enhances the appeal to outsiders. However, this process is dynamic. It requires oscillation along a continuum between the predicament of disrepute, in which a movement is discredited, and the predicament of respectability, wherein it is absorbed into society. While I suspect that Armin's theoretical musings follow as much from in the past three decades as from his general interest in the sociology of religion, he clearly intends to use the Mormon case as compelling evidence for his theoretical model. The model enables us to understand recent Mormon experience, and recent Mormon experience provides an important means of broadening our theoretical understanding of religious movements. Armand, in my judgment, has succeeded in both of these tasks. The angel symbolizes the distinctive charismatic element, the unique beliefs, rituals, and practices linking Mormons to the sacred, while the beehive symbolizes the host society, its values, beliefs, and demands. During the first half of the 20th century, Mormonism's quest for respectability became one of the most successful assimilation stories in American history. But the prospects of complete assimilation and the corresponding loss of the distinctive Mormon identity led to a renewed emphasis on Mormon peculiarity, a turning toward the angel, a more or less conscious retrenchment strategy designed to delineate social and cultural boundaries, at least symbolically, between Mormons and others. This retrenchment probably began around 1960, as Mormon peculiarity again becomes a problem by inhibiting the retention of members or impeding church growth. We might suspect, from Mormon's theoretical model, another phase of assimilation as church leaders adopt organizational strategies and the saints devise informal practices facilitating a new relationship with society. If the church successfully maintains this optimum tension with its host societies, it may well become the new world religion envisioned by Jan Shipps, with members of more than 200 million saints by 2080, projected by Rodney Stark. Does Armand's evidence support his retrenchment thesis? I think so. He can demonstrate a growing conservatism, both religiously and politically, among Mormons through his own pioneering surveys of Mormon religiosity during the 60s and the National Opinion Research Center data from the 80s, even if the samples are not clearly comparable. His analysis of institutional changes, especially the implications of the church correlation program established during the 60s, enable him to document trends toward the centralization of power, the standardization of meetings, manuals, teaching processes, missionary lessons, etc., and the simplification of doctrines, beliefs, and ideas. The secondary sources which he mobilizes in support of his argument certainly document contemporary propensities toward a greater affinity with conservative Protestant Christologies and doctrines of salvation reflected in novel developments in Mormon theology, canonization, leadership rhetoric, hymnals, and official political activity. While these studies originated independently from Armand's work, and for that matter from one another, Armand does not need to stretch credulity to claim that much of the recent research in Mormonism is clearly compatible with his thesis. Certainly in this sense, Armand has quite compelling evidence on his side. In short, none of this research contradicts his basic claims. But is the failure to contradict his claims sufficient? Many of the trends discussed by Armand and much of the literature he has cited are amenable to a quite different interpretation. It's possible to view institutional policies, Mormon politics, and theological developments as a continuation of, rather than a retreat from, the assimilation process. If we perceive the 60s, especially from the mid-decade onward, as a bit of an aberration in recent American experience, then we may be inclined to regard the presidential administrations, with the possible exception of Jimmy Carter's, as reflecting a more conservative national mood. Epitomized in the two elections of Ronald Reagan, the national climate to which Mormonism might be expected to accommodate was particularly compatible with the interests of the most conservative Mormon authorities. Those religious fundamentalists who either sat on the sidelines because of a theological inclination toward asceticism, or simply had been part of the American political landscape, but as marginal players, were now fully legitimated, with Ronald Reagan, a true believer, if not practitioner, at the helm of the ship of state. Efforts to reassure others that Mormonism is fully Christian, the corresponding trends toward conservative Protestant Christologies and the growing affinity with neo-Orthodox and fundamentalist theologies may reflect further assimilation into a more conservative American ethos. The Mormon dietary code and the preoccupation with family values would certainly not set the Latter-day Saints off from the nation. If anything, as Armand has argued on other occasions, Mormonism's social agenda appeared to be encoded in contemporary American culture. It had, it seems to me, become the platform of the then ruling political party. Organized political action against pornography, the Equal Rights Amendment, and gay and lesbian rights probably reflect more of the church's vested interest in the established power structures in America than a turn inward toward the angel. Indeed, even the most significant change in church policy during the 20th century, the 1978 revelation admitting Black Latter-day Saints into full fellowship into the church, contrary to the positions of two of my colleagues on the panel, Armand and Jan, may be regarded as the high point of Mormon assimilation. Neither the fact that overt political pressures were relaxed from their peak during the late 60s and early 70s, nor the fact that the church's success in Brazil had presented it with a serious dilemma. What if you build a temple and nobody can come? Negates the rewards the church would realize by finally capitulating to external and internal pressures demanding that the Mormons be at least as accommodating on racial issues as other American churches if they were to enjoy the respectability they had so long sought. Even C. Eric Lincoln, a distinguished black scholar, saw the Mormon revelation as the removal of the last vestige of official racism by a major American denomination. Having suggested that the data Armand marshals to support his thesis can often be interpreted differently, does not mean that I find his thesis implausible, nor that I believe his argument is weak. His treatment of temple work, the preoccupation with the family, and the focus on religious indoctrination are particularly convincing evidence for Mormonism's turn inward toward the angel. I simply have raised the above to suggest that a case can still be made for a more linear move toward assimilation. Through the remainder of my remarks, I'll comment on some implications of Armand's analysis for the debate over Mormon ethnicity, argue for a distinction between the church and community, and reflect on how the changes Armand so clearly documents have apparently affected him and me. No one has made a more important contribution to our understanding of the ideological uses of the notion of Mormon ethnicity than Armand. In some of his other work, he has shown how the church, especially the public relations department, may benefit from Mormons being defined as an ethnic group. And he has pointed out that scholars sometimes have a vested interest in conceptualizing the Mormon experience in ethnic terms, since this further legitimates the study of Mormonism. In other words, as Mormons become more important, a more important object for historical and social scientific analysis, scholars publishing on Mormonism enhance their own personal academic careers. The vested interest of church leaders, folk Mormons, and intellectuals converge to promote this notion of Mormon ethnicity, which Armin finds dubious at best and absurd at worst. If Mormonism, conceived as a distinct people, an ethnic group, has any meaning at all, it must be limited to the 19th century when the saints pursued a separate, autonomous social order. In the latter half of the 20th century, when the conceptualization of Mormons as ethnics gained currency, Mormons were at the peak of their respectability and had almost assimilated into American culture or American society. It strikes Armand as odd that this would be the point when people would begin serious consideration of Mormon ethnicity, implying that the concept had little value in enabling us to better understand the Mormon phenomenon. The fact that academic careers might be built on the growing respectability of Mormon studies, of course, does not mean that the conceptualization was without value in the study of Mormonism itself, nor that the Mormon case was not instructive for clarifying some major theoretical issues. Martin Marty's recent assertion that it's more useful to conceive of the Mormons as, quote, a people, unquote, than a church because of their shared story falls under surprisingly harsh judgment. Surely it becomes ludicrous, writes Armand, and I now quote, if we go far beyond the common religious tradition or story and attempt to define Mormons from all cultures and colors of the world as somehow constituting a new and separate ethnic category. Why not call it a New World religion, as Jan Shipps and Rodney Stark would have it? Indeed, there is something incongruous and antithetical about thinking of the Mormons as a world church and a separate ethnic group at the same time, end of quote. But is Marty's claim ludicrous? To begin with, he's trying to say something that Armand is reminding us about. Mormonism is unique in crucial ways that make it neither a clearly identifiable sect nor an assimilated church. There's something about the character of Mormonism that distinguishes it from typical Christian denominations. Mormonism's successful oscillation between resistance and absorption into American society and culture, to use Armand's framework, has left it with an especially compelling story, informing a collective identity that, if not unique in American experience, is the nonetheless more vibrant, textured, and pronounced than is typical of many denominations. I do not know if Marty would balk at considering Mormonism a New World religion, but I suspect he would be surprised to discover that there was something incongruent or antithetical about thinking of Mormonism in such terms at the same time Mormons were conceived as a people or an ethnic group. Surely we think of Judaism and Islam precisely in these ways. It seems to me that Armand's shift from the language of, quote, New World religion to, quote, a world church may be significant for his claim about incongruence. I, too, would find the identification of a world church and ethnicity problematic, but I see no inherent incompatibility between a world religion and ethnicity. Church is an organization, an institution, while a religion encompasses much more. Its patterns of social organization typically transcend the institutional church, including a broader community, possibly a variety of subcultures with distinctive belief system, ritual practice, and behavioral requirements. We are participating today, wittingly or not, in the Mormon religion. These Sunstone Symposia, which are not the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion, nor the American Historical Association, are part of the Mormon community, but we've been explicitly informed by the First Presidency, lest any of us have any lingering doubts, that Sunstone is not part of the institutional church. It is clearly possible, from my perspective, to participate in the Mormon community and not the Mormon church. Obviously, I'm suggesting that the community and the church are not coterminous. Community is larger than the church, and its boundaries are expanding. The community includes various subcultures linked to Mormonism through a common identity and perpetuated through their own media and organizations. While the community obviously includes the church, I'm convinced, has lost control of the community and can no longer dictate or define Mormon culture. That the church remains the most powerful force within the Mormon community may be beyond dispute, but I believe it lacks the power, though perhaps not the will, to set the agenda and define the parameters of Mormon life. For today, at least the intellectual segment of the Mormon community attracts a diverse population, is increasingly well-organized, and enjoys some popular support. The recent responses of church officials to the Sunstone Symposia and attempts to intimidate participating intellectuals appear to me as a concerted effort to reestablish the church's hegemony over the Mormon community. But this, I'm confident, is too late. In the end, it will fail. I hope that the distinction between the community and church will clarify some of my points regarding Armin's analysis and perhaps enable us to better understand our respective relationships to Mormonism. Let me say it a moment, just as a comment here, too. I think the distinction is useful in dealing with the question of Mormon ethnicity, that it's in the context of a community that produces the kind of sources of identity and the basic kind of social organization that makes possible something comparable to an ethnic group. Okay, back to this other point. I hope the distinction between the community and the church will clarify some points regarding Armin's analysis, perhaps enable us to better understand our respective relationships to Mormonism. As the saints turn inward toward the angel in their contemporary retrenchment, they seek new identity markers to clarify the meaning of being Mormon in a world with which they've become too comfortable. While some search for identity within the fabric of the institutional church, others' quests take them through one or more of the various subcultures comprising the Mormon community. Whether efforts to construct a collective identity are successful enough to warrant the label of Mormon ethnicity or merely constitute a symbolic means of delineating loose boundaries between the Latter-day Saints and their host society remains a matter for debate. In the meantime, Armand, as he confesses in the preface, has, quote, come to feel increasingly marginal to the Mormon community during my adult life, at least in a social and intellectual sense, despite my continuing and conscientious participation in church activity, including leadership, and despite my own deep personal faith in the religion itself. I, on the other hand, who left institutional Mormonism in the mid-60s, have neither the inclination nor the credentials for activity in the church. But I must confess to a growing sense of participation in a Mormon community, as conceptualized above. I realize that Armin may be using community and church as synonyms, or conceiving of the community as active Mormons, both within and outside of formal church settings. So, by my usage of Mormon community, he may not feel alienated. However, if he does mean Mormon community in the sense in which I've used the concept, then I would find it fascinating that he would be alienated from the community while participating in the institution, while I've been alienated from the institution but feel comfortable participating in the community.
I suspect, in a way, that there will be some repetition and variation since we didn't get together ahead of time to say who's going to do what. And so if what I do is not unlike what Professor White has done, it has slight variations. Armand Moss's book is the culmination of work in which he has been engaged for more than a quarter of a century. Its thesis derives from recent variations on Ernest Trelch's cyclical church-sect-church model that posits two ideal types of relationships between religion and culture. At the church end of the continuum that stretches between these two ideal types, the rapprochement between religion and culture has reached a point of such stasis that the two are virtually indistinguishable. At the other, or sectarian end, religion and culture are in such a state of high tension that they appear to be separate entities at war with each other. Both sides work at maintaining a wall of separation that keeps them apart. In this model, the danger posed for the sectarian body by a reduction of the tension that keeps religion, and in this formulation the angel, apart from culture, the beehive of economics and politics, is religion's assimilation, its integration into or absorption by the culture. Since this is a consummation devoutly to be opposed if a religious body is to retain its viability and distinctiveness, movement along the continuum away from the sectarian end is risky, if not downright perilous, to a religious group. While it is also risky, and oh, by the way, did you know that Marty thinks that Lutherans are a group too, a people? Yeah, so we begin to put him in context right there. While it is also risky and perilous to attempt to paraphrase the argument of a work as multifaceted as this one, that is, it seems to me, the best way to make any useful commentary on this book. So I will try. Now, this is my reading. I'm sure not the reading that Armand would give it, but my reading of the thesis of this book. Although Mormonism, the Utah variety, is technically not a sect, it has certain sectarian characteristics. For almost a century after it was founded, Mormons existed in a state of high tension with the surrounding culture. The tension was primarily but not entirely due to the maintenance of a wall of separation between the church and the world that was maintained by the host culture, that is, the United States. By 1960, the level of tension between the church and the world, the angel and the beehive, had diminished so precipitously that Mormonism was in serious danger of being assimilated into the larger culture, thereby losing its distinctiveness. Sensing the danger, the authorities, this is sort of the third point, sensing the danger, the authorities of the LDS Church took a series of more or less deliberate steps to avert assimilation, all of which were designed to increase the level of tension between the church and the world. These steps, which Armand categorizes as retrenchment, include reassertion of the principle of continuous revelation through modern prophets, and a re-emphasis on obedience to modern prophets. Second, a new and increased stress on genealogy and temple work. Three, expansion and standardization of the missionary program. Four, family renewal and retrenchment. And five, an expanded program of religious education with a new mandate for indoctrination rather than intellectual reconciliation. And then the fourth point, Mormons are responding at the grassroots and folk level to these initiatives in various ways, but the jury is still out as to whether a sufficiently high level of tension can be maintained to prevent the danger of assimilation from reasserting itself into Mormonism. In the meantime, a fruitful approach, Armin believes, is to compare the Mormon response to the fundamentalist response within American Protestantism, since this will illuminate the move toward neo-orthodoxy within Mormonism. Along the way to this argument and the consideration of the grassroots and folk responses to the official response to assimilation, Armin writes a number of mini essays on what has been going on in Zion in the past 2 decades or 3 decades, and he makes many thought-provoking observations which students of and at least some participants in Mormon culture will surely appreciate. For all that, the matter of whether Armin is correct in his judgment that Mormons were dangerously close to being assimilated into the larger culture in the 1960s remains, as does the matter of what he characterizes as the official response is best explained in terms of avoiding assimilation. Now, I should stop here, and I'll just talk off the cuff a bit, to say that one thing that I found somewhat difficult to get consistently throughout the book was the distinction between the loss of or the angel being swallowed up by the beehive within Mormonism and Mormonism being swallowed up by the larger American culture. And I kept trying to figure out at one or another point which of these being assimilated or dangers was meant in which point. My own suspicion is that despite the responses in his statistical sample that suggest a level of distance from the church that could signify assimilation in the 1960s, that might not be what was going on if we consider both church and culture together. And now I'm talking about Mormon culture or the Mormon community in the same way that, can I call you Kendall? That Kendall has talked about the church being a part of the community but not coterminous with it. Now, having never met a Mormon and never knowing anything about this faith and this people, I can testify that the immediate danger of assimilation into the surrounding culture, that is, the culture then known as Gentile, was more apparent than real. In 1960, I moved to Logan, Utah, which was 95% Mormon. And from the outside, for the first few days, I thought it had been pretty much assimilated into American culture, not much different. But remember those Twilight Zone stories where somebody goes tootling down the highway and the car breaks down and the person parks the car into a little town and asks that it's going to be repaired and it'll take 2 or 3 days, and he goes over to eat something in the restaurant and gradually he discovers that things are ever so slightly different. Well, for a person coming from the outside, never having been west and never, and how much that is, never having been west and never having met a Mormon went together, I'm not quite sure. But within a month, especially since my husband and I had been working in a home for delinquent girls and had had 6 years without drinking and had decided, we were so dumb we didn't know you had a cocktail before dinner, and so we had decided to start having a drink after dinner, and when the visiting teachers came, we would always have just poured that drink. We very soon began to feel a kind of culture shock. It wasn't the visiting teachers and the fact that we were trying to learn to drink, which is what we were trying to do, but it was to us what seemed to us the community of Mormons, active and Jack Mormons, as they were called in those days. And the distinction seemed to us to be two sides of a coin that still was not a coin that was a part of any of the cultures that we had lived in up to that time, and we had lived in many different cultures, or in many different parts of the United States. Moreover, 1960 is a problematic year to use as a baseline for comparative analysis, and for reasons that extend far beyond the fact that this was the year I came to Utah and met enough unassimilated Mormons to cause me to spend a great deal of my life trying to understand them. 1960 is close enough to the years of isolation in which Mormonism existed as a cultural as well as religious enclave in the American West for measures of how distanced Latter-day Saints were from their religion do not serve sufficiently as a measure of Mormon assimilation to the larger culture. The ethnicity issue was still important in terms of real as opposed to symbolic ethnicity, and that's the way I'm beginning to think of this problem of Mormon ethnicity. But this was also the year, remember, in which, for the first time since the 1960s, that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints grew more by convert baptisms than by natural increase. And it was also the year in which the impact of the GI Bill on Mormon intellectuals began truly to reflect itself as those who had received training in institutions of higher learning outside Zion's boundaries came back into the Mormon culture to teach and to be a part of that culture. I've done an analysis of who has studied where among Mormons in the 40s and 50s, and you can just see that the move outward so that people are studying in the best universities in the country rather than BYU and the University of Utah proceeds apace, accelerating from 1948 forward. An alternative explanation is that within the Mormon world itself, the level of tension between religion and culture had been significantly reduced. The angel was, in fact, I suspect, very much being swallowed up, or if not swallowed up, in danger of being swallowed up by the beehive. At the same time, the level of tension between the Mormon world and the world outside had also declined almost to the point in which overt expression was beginning to disappear. But I emphasize overt. After all, this was the period of Victor Jory, Rosemarie Reed, Johnny Miller, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, and the reader's digesting of those amazing Mormons. But the line between vilification and idealization is very thin. Too thin to support the sort of disappearance of difference that would make true assimilation possible. This meant that for the Mormon community generally, assimilation was not such a danger in those days, at least as far as being swallowed up by the larger culture than it might now appear. My graduate school experience was seriously lacking in instruction in both sociological theory and statistics. But as part of my checkered career, I spent more than 2 years working at the Institute for Sex Research, where statistics was king, queen, and crown prince. There, and you know, after all, you learn statistics, and at least the stuff you're deciding, the percentages are sort of interesting because the stuff has a sort of intrinsic interest. So you're not just talking about how much people weigh and how tall they are. There I learned the principle of the intervening variable, the principle that challenges interpreters to watch out for a variable that might complicate explanation or even turn it in another direction. I acknowledge the contribution of this book in providing convincing and useful explanation on a wide array of issues. Especially pertinent are the author's observations about the impact of the shift from having general authorities experienced in business and management rather than leaders trained in the humanities, and his analysis of the gerontocracy problem, which is the best I have seen. Yet I must admit that I see an intervening variable that makes the thesis and the argument less than fully persuasive. Now, I don't mean it's not persuasive, but less than fully persuasive. This is the geographical expansion and numerical growth of the church. In view of the lay clerical organization of the Mormon Church and the consequent need to both create a knowledge base about Mormonism among converts and to generate Mormon identities strong enough and secure enough to allow native Mormon communities to flourish around the world, I see what Armin calls the official response to the danger of assimilation in a somewhat different light. I see much of what has happened since 1960 as a response to pressures that result as much or more from church growth and geographic expansion than the danger of assimilation in American culture. I also see something that equals in importance the retrenchment described in this volume, and that is the profound change in what it means to be Mormon today and what it meant to be Mormon yesterday, especially is this true in the mission field. But I will be talking about all that tomorrow night. For now, I say bravo to Armin Moss for writing a book that is bound to get conversation going about what has been happening in Mormon's second century, and it's about time it did get going.
Well, I actually feel that after all that, we really could just let Armin talk and go home. Most everything has been said. But since they asked me to speak, I'll go ahead and say a few things. I think Armin Moss has produced a very important book. It takes stock of Mormonism during the last half century. His work is important for a number of reasons. First of all, it serves as a synthesis of the ever-growing sociological and anthropological Mormon studies, which is perhaps an area that many people aren't familiar with since history and theological work has carried the flame of Mormon studies for so long. And to have a work of this magnitude appear, I think, is a marvelous statement, and particularly given its synthetic value. It is also a recognition and illustration of the growing contribution of sociology to the understanding of the church. It also exemplifies the increasing commitment of non-Mormon publishers and scholarly presses to publish serious works on Mormonism. And it testifies to the interest of a relatively broad non-Mormon audience, as well as Mormon studies' growing presence and respectability within academia. In this sense, at a time of ecclesiastical challenge to the Mormon scholarly community, Moss's work signals of Mormon studies, to use a metaphor I used before, the horses of Mormon studies truly are loosed from the church's stable and will never easily be gathered in again. Perhaps the book's greatest importance, though, lies in the information and the understanding it brings to its theme. Although its argument, which has been stressed by my colleagues, is of course of theoretical importance to social scientists, and perhaps others, it is even of more interest to Mormons, such as myself, who have lived through so much of it. The interaction of the theory with the data produces much light. It illuminates the structural dynamics of much of my life, my loves, and my frustrations, since I was born in 1955, have grown and lived in the period that Armin is talking about. And it's nice to see a synthesis of my Mormonism instead of the Mormonism of Joseph Smith, of Brigham Young, of Heber J. Grant, and so on, great though their Mormonism is. Moss may write with a classical rigor and dryness of sociology. And let me say in parentheses, there's been much criticism of sociological writing. Moss does not fall afoul of the criticism of sociological writing. This is a beautifully written book, given its theme, its style, its caution, and its rigor. But nonetheless, given that, his work clarifies so much of what has happened in my life that it demonstrates to me, once again, the value of cautious sociological analysis. I'm an anthropologist, yet this demonstrates the value of cautious sociological analysis to bring sudden flashes of insight to our everyday quandaries. I find Moss's work interesting on another level. This is not a simple text of one or two or three or four variables in interaction. Rather, Moss focuses on a dialectical tension between two forces, those of separation and assimilation. He does not remain at the level of a simple dialectic. He splits that, divides it, and redivides it so that it operates on multiple levels, making his text enormously complex and perhaps difficult sometimes to pull together, following Jan Schip's criticism. But he stresses the level of the official versus the individual. I found this refreshing. All too often we speak of the official church, or then we have personal essays about the individual. Moss brings together great data about the individual members of the church and shows the interrelationship between individual life processes and those of official church policies. To me, that was useful, interesting, and very important. He illuminates the core versus the periphery, where that dynamic is also important in understanding different manifestations of Mormonism. But he also argues for historical processes of growth and structural change, not history in the sense of 1800 to 1900 to the year 2000, but history in the sense of every area progressing along its own set of relationships, its own dynamics in terms of structural relationships. He also, of course, as a good sociologist, refers to the classical sociological variables of class, education, and gender, etc., which I found quite informative. Building on the explanation of institutional change as well as 1960s survey research, Moss argues, my colleagues had noted, that Mormons had by mid-century attained considerable similarity to their fellow Americans. They now swam solidly, he argues, in the mainstream, sharing social and political attitudes as well as levels of educational and professional attainment. He shows this assimilation was marked by changes in general conference rhetoric, hymnody, doctrine. I found interesting his notion of the codification of the doctrine of deity, reducing its more outrageous aspect. He, of course, is right. But I was raised post the outrageous aspect, and there are still outrageous aspects about the Mormon doctrine of deity, as many of our Protestant fundamentalist colleagues will take many pains in letting us know. At the grassroots level, this was marked by increasing demystification of religion. I found that an interesting observation. Demystification of Mormon religion. It makes me wonder more about my grandparents' religion, their experience of the life of Mormonism, the life of the mind. I know that in my life, perhaps as a process of education, Mormonism has been even more increasingly demystified. Perhaps it's simply a process of growing up. I don't know. But I found that to be an interesting notion that I would like to see explored more. He also spoke about the changing of ritual involving loss of more charismatic elements. I found those to be intriguing observations that I would also like to see explored more. What is Mormon ritual? What is its relationship to the various communities of Mormons? As Armin stresses, there are varying communities of Mormons. But this assimilation, as Armin noted, created a problem. To the degree that his church and members continued to assimilate, they would lose their peculiarity and hence run the risk of becoming less successful as a religious movement. But the responses to this difficulty have included paradoxes, produced paradoxes, and strange consequences, which Moss carefully outlines. Again, I find the paradoxes more enlightening than the causal relationships. Perhaps I'm an anthropologist again, but those paradoxes are fun. They're fascinating. Moss notes three levels of responses, the official, the folk, and the intellectual. And in interaction, they produce the paradoxes as well as the reality we see today. At the official level, he notes the changing occupational backgrounds of the GAs have favored an increasingly limited cognitive set. In other words, Armand relates the ideas of the general authority to their occupational background. This is a revolutionary act in Mormon studies. To take the writings of the brethren, although he does it in a few sentences, to take the writings of the brethren and argue that there's a causal relationship between the themes of their writing or the overall framework of the writing and their occupation. Now, of course, that's a sociology of knowledge truism. It should have been done a long time ago. But nonetheless, it's challenging to notions produced by people like Elder Packer that we are not to do that kind of exegesis of the brethren's writing. But as a Latter-day Saint, I find that very informative and challenging because it forces me to think through what the religious qualities of the brethren's writing that I find valuable are, and it forces me to think about how I might discount or value the contributions and limitations that come from their occupational status. To this, Armin adds that there have been five official thrusts of retrenchment. Retrenchment has already been noted, so I will skip them. The grassroots to this illustrates general compliance on the whole. But Armin's data, and Armin in passing also notes, that there are also degrees of variation and noncompliance as well that vary by region, social context, period of Mormon growth, and educational difference. Again, I find the variation more fascinating than the compliance. And I would like to know more about that variation in Mormon realities at the grassroots level. Moss notes that Mormons have grown somewhat more religious since the 60s, especially when compared with other Americans. But they remain as conservative. Then in passing, he notes once again a fascinating but. They illustrate curious liberalism when it comes to attitudes on civil rights and women's rights. He also argues that various structural factors have contributed to a growing Mormon fundamentalism of the Protestant sort. Let me take a big marker and draw a big line star right here and let everybody know that we have to change our language. No longer can we simply use the term fundamentalism in Mormon studies to refer to polygamists, as if polygamy and fundamentalism are synonymous. Armand, by using the word fundamentalism, is relating processes in Mormonism to very broad international processes that have afflicted not just religious movements, but ideologies of all stripes as they interrelate with social organization throughout the world. That is important. So to speak of Mormon fundamentalism now, we have to speak not just of polygamy, but also of ideas such as biblical inerrancy. We have to speak of McConkie, in other words, Packer, and perhaps intellectuals. Perhaps even us liberals, quote-unquote, although I hate the word, may also fall afoul of a certain fundamentalism, as I might get to later. Armin claims that this new fundamentalism is due to various factors at the official and folk levels. At the institutional level, we have the impact of a lay clergy. Again, I found his analysis brilliant of how the lay clergy is able to recycle folk ideology, bring it in, sacralize it, and thereby bring fundamentalism in through the back door. How does it happen? Well, we don't have a tradition of canon law that lets us know what's legitimate and what's illegitimate. Instead, we rely on authority to tell us. Thereby, we get absurdities such as Elder Packer telling us things about that are absolutely contrary to scientific fact in many of his writings about gender and other things that one could go on and on about. Folk wisdom moves from the folk to the top, becomes sacralized, and then becomes a measure of constancy, of lack of change in the writing of people like Elder Packer, whereby he can say the gospel never changes. But in doing so, he's taken what was never the gospel, makes it the gospel, and then sacralizes it. An interesting process. Armin isn't quite as blunt as I am, but he gives the message and the mechanism by which it happens, and I thought he did so brilliantly. This lay clergy blurs the distinction between folk and elite levels of religious expression, and this is important. Furthermore, Armin points out that we have a perennial vacuum of power in the First Presidency and argues that this lets rogue apostles, who are strong-willed conservatives, exercise undue influence. I think at times his analysis gets a little fuzzy in this point, and it could definitely benefit by interaction with some of Mike Quinn's work in more detail. But I think Armin makes a very good point. And I think it would behoove us to study these, quote, rogue apostles, unquote, my quote, not his quote, to see the influence, the power they've actually had on Mormonism. How does this happen? What is the actual social process by which a McConkie, with his work, becomes popularly canonized, and then that canonization rotates up to the elite levels of the church bureaucracy as well as general authorities? How does Elder Packer become canonized at a popular and then a formal level? These are interesting questions to which Armand opens the door. Importantly, Armand also notes that there have always been Mormon tendencies towards fundamentalism. They've merely ebbed and flowed while interacting with other Mormon viewpoints. This is another critical point. Moss notes that the priesthood correlation, centralized management, and so on have further bedded fundamentalism by undermining a Mormon sense of community and identity. This undermining of the sense of community, I agree with him. I think he's absolutely right. That correlation has taken away the means by which we develop Mormon community. In many ways, Mormonism seems to me right now is almost another Protestant go-to-church-on-Sunday denomination in many ways than it does the Mormonism of my youth, where it was almost the entire life, and where, frankly, we kids had very little time to do anything but church. My dad did things other than church, but my mother was constantly involved in church. I was constantly involved in church, and for all intents and purposes, I grew up in a Mormon enclave, although most of my neighbors were non-Mormon. There's not as much interaction with them as there was with Mormons. And that's an important distinction. That's a result of correlation. And I'll come back to that point in a minute. But this production of a mentality, a fundamentalism, is an interesting one. Armand argues that part of the process that it creates an insecurity in Mormon lives, requiring the Mormons seek their own kind of distinctiveness, since they're not getting it quite so easily from the official church. And as a result, they seize on themes that are in the popular culture. It also creates a strong dynamic towards folk fundamentalism. I've heard the discussion many times from my students. What does it mean to be a Latter-day Saint? Perhaps the new distinction is not going to R-rated movies. Or perhaps the new distinction is not believing in evolution. Or believing absolutely rabidly in biblical inerrancy. I think Armand's talking about this collapse of the church mechanisms for building a sense of community, leaving members adrift to create their own identity in a very shallow, formal structure, is very important towards understanding the current dynamics within Mormonism, because it does mean that Latter-day Saints have to find their own ways, and thereby they're very, very influenced by ideas in the popular culture that are outside of Mormonism, but then cycle inward. This also, a correlation has also fostered mentality, or created a mentality that fosters conformity and question obedience in Armand's writing. I find Moss's work exciting and useful, and I congratulate him for having given it to us. But if I only remained celebratory, I would not be completely fulfilling my role. So if in the interest of scholarly debate, I must raise one or two criticisms. Armand notes the rise in the discussions of Mormon ethnicity. It's interesting that all three of us have focused on that because it's really a very minor part of his work. But it's topical, I guess. Armand notes the rise in discussions of Mormon ethnicity. He argues there's no empirical basis for claims of Mormon ethnicity and that the claims of themselves are more sociologically interesting. I agree with him. The claims are very sociologically interesting. Why is there such a focus, a fascination on Mormon ethnicity right now? Good question. Who are the people who are focusing on it? Are they the Kendall Whites or are they the Armand Mosses? Is Armand right that it's a focus of perhaps building, by implication, he argues this, a focus for building a sense of Mormon community when the church no longer fills it? Or is Armand's own argument that the church has lost its functions of building community, is Armand's own argument the reason why there's such a focus on Mormon ethnicity? I don't know. Let's study it. But I also have to disagree with Armand. In fact, the issue of whether there is or is not an empirical basis for Mormon ethnicity is frankly irrelevant. Numerous ethnic groups around the world, functional, strong ethnic groups, have very little empirical claim to ethnic status, either in terms of biology or history. Let me note that the notion of ethnicity is dubious when applied to Asian Americans. What are they? Hmong, Lao, Tibetan, Indian, Chinese? But in the United States, they become ethnic Asian Americans, although many of them resist it. The notion of Mexican Americans is troublesome and problematic. The notion of Anglo-Americans is problematic. Every notion of ethnicity in the United States is problematic when put to the test of empirical validation that Armand demands. He falls afoul of what Geertz called in anthropology the primordial fallacy. I'm not going to demand that Armand already know anthropology. But he falls afoul of what Geertz calls a primordial fallacy. That is, the accepting the claims of the ideologues that ethnicity is grounded in a historically validated peopleness that is objective. Unfortunately, this concept entered the social science literature and has remained. But numerous theorists over the last 30 years have demonstrated its fallaciousness. For example, look at Frederick Barth and his argument that it's boundaries that constructs ethnicity, not the solidity of ethnic reality. To quote Saussure, there is nothing but difference. Il n'y a que la différence. There is nothing but difference. It is not the objective reality of ethnicity that is a real point, but rather the difference, the relationships among groups that are socially constructed, and how the boundaries are maintained according to Barth's analysis. And more recently, Eric Hobsbawm, in his analysis of nationalism and ethnicity, in Western Europe has also pointed out the fallaciousness, as has Hobsbawm in his arguments about constructed tradition, where most of the traditions, including ethnicities that we have in our modern world, were constructed at the end of the century, but they argued a primordialness. Nationalism is another argument that argues towards primordialness that really has very little substance. In empirical terms, even American Jews, most of them, would show little empirical distinctiveness from the body of American culture. Arment uses the example of Judaism. Thus, empirical distinctiveness is better seen as one of the variables of ethnicity between different Jewish groups, or between, for example, the highly distinctive Mexican Americans of the lower Rio Grande Valley, distinctive when compared to broad American culture, not when compared to the context of the culture within which they live, or the English-dominant Chicanos of Utah, for example. Let me also note that Armin's argument about assimilation, the factuality of assimilation, also fails if I go internationally. If I look at the notion of ethnicity in Bolivia, I notice that, again, ethnicity is starting to become a very common argument and discussion. It's one of the dynamic themes, major themes of Bolivian life. Hundreds of books are being produced right now about ethnicity within Bolivia, whereas 20 years ago, no, it was social class. Why? Well, it's interesting to note that this is occurring precisely when the indices, the measures of Indianness, are at their weakest level historically ever. So there's probably a causal relationship between Armin's argument about assimilation and the arguments for ethnicity. So it may indeed be that ethnicity itself is a phenomenon of the loss of empirical ethnicity. In other words, when we lose our distinctiveness, suddenly we have something to grab on, so our ideologues start creating ethnicity to create a boundary. Therefore, we have to distinguish between the ideological ethnicity and the empirical ethnicity, which is why distinctiveness needs to be a variable, not a final argument. Okay, very minor point, though. Armin does a very good job, and as I said, I'm an anthropologist, and sociologists have no need to know anthropology. One other point that I think is very important, and then I will sit down and let everybody else respond. Armin's argument about fundamentalism is very interesting and very good. But to my mind, it focuses too much on internal Mormon dynamics and doesn't draw enough on the broader American dynamics that have led to a resurgence of fundamentalism and the division of American society into two camps. I recently read the book by the sociologist Wuthnow. I can't remember the title of it. It's something about changing American religion, where he argues this restructuring of American religion. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. It's certainly a good complement as well as a contrast to Armin's work, where Armin's work becomes a case study. If I remember correctly, I didn't have time before this to go and look at it, and it was already 4 months ago I read it. But if I remember correctly, Wuthnow argues that across the board, American religion has been divided into two camps, what he calls the liberals and the conservatives. The fundamentalists are an example of the conservatives. He argues the liberals tend to focus on issues of related to the Second Commandment, loving your neighbor. Whereas the fundamentalists tend to, quote, focus more on legalistic issues about the gospel and so on. An interesting point from my perspective is that Wuthnow argues that most sects and denominations have been split. They have both liberal and fundamentalist camps. And this explains much of the dynamics within denominations. But also of interest from Wuthnow's arguments, the fundamentalists of one church are more similar to the fundamentalists of another church than they are to the liberals who occupy the same denomination. So Wuthnow argues that the United States is being split into two warring camps. Interesting argument. Because he sees the liberals as having rather higher educational attainment than the liberals. And he argues for higher education as being a causal contributor to the development of liberalism. Well, in the Mormon case, this is fascinating because, as Armin and others have pointed out, most Latter-day Saints, well, in most studies have pointed out there's a correlation between high educational attainment and high commitment to Mormonism. Makes us weird. We're also weird because the official church is becoming almost exclusively fundamentalist, hence Armin's feeling of exclusion, which also makes us in some ways unusual. But Armin puts a cavil earlier, although he probably didn't plan it to be for this argument, where he notes that within Mormonism, those Latter-day Saints who study social sciences and liberal arts tend to have weaker commitment, weaker indexes of orthodoxy than those in other educational fields. It would be interesting to look at the Sunstoners and see how many of us have backgrounds in liberal arts in one way or another. and see whether that holds across the case, or look at Mormon liberals as a whole. But nonetheless, despite the internal dynamics of Mormonism, our peculiarities and differences, perhaps the turn towards fundamentalism is as much an indication of further assimilation as it is of retrenchment. In other words, when I hear the fundamentalists, to me they sound more like Baptists. They sound like they've lost Mormonism and have gone to Baptist thought, the Baptists I knew in Texas, than they do like the Mormonism I grew up with and have studied. And it seems to me that when I listen to Elder Packer, he's assimilating to poorly thought conservative thought, then he recreates Mormonism other than follow the prophet, follow the prophet, follow the prophet. And forgive me, I don't mean to wail on Elder Packer. I've just been reading a lot of Elder Packer. So he's an easy example. So let me close by saying, in support of what both my colleagues have said, that Armin's argument can be read both ways, as an index of further assimilation as well as retrenchment. Is that a problem? Not at all. It does not challenge at all what is a very important and excellent work. Both dynamics are actually possible, and they could occur simultaneously, and the functional reality could be that both are true. The intention may have been of retrenchment. The reality may have been of assimilation. Thank you. And thank you, Armand.
I would like to thank my colleagues for their very generous comments. They either didn't notice a lot of the weaknesses that I know, or they were kind enough not to bring them up, and that's much appreciated. I won't say much by way of response, you'll be relieved to know, because I would like to hear what some of you from the audience might like to ask. I have to comment on Jan's experiences on her arrival in Logan in, what was it, about 1960? Well, you see, I arrived in Logan in 1967, and I felt just as strange as she did. I had grown up in California. I came to Logan to take an appointment in the sociology department at Utah State, which lasted providentially for me only 2 years. And the culture shock was extraordinary. I was converted from a stodgy conservative to a flaming liberal without ever having changed an idea. And so I don't think Logan is a very good example of how much Mormonism might have assimilated or not. I think it still wouldn't be a very good example. I take the point, though, that one can emphasize too much, and maybe I did, the degree of assimilation and the year 1960. I'd like to enter something of a disclaimer, or at least a caveat, which I did try to do in the text, maybe only in footnotes, about that. First of all, I usually use terms like about 1960 or about mid-century. I'm not very precise about it because I don't really know. When you start introducing ideas about trends in history, you know, it's not like following a football game in downs and quarters. It's not like somebody flips a switch and we go from assimilation to something else. I may have given that kind of an impression inadvertently, but with historical trends, it's always the case that some developments are occurring that have been there for a long time and may be winding down and petering out as new ones are starting up, kind of overlapping with it. And so it's kind of messy. It's not very clear. And so that to say that that assimilation had reached a certain point and that since then the theme has been more one of retrenchment is not to say that there's no more assimilation that's gone on since 1960. I mean, you only have to look at the careful public relations program of the church to realize that the church leaders still care a lot about good the church's public image is. So it's kind of a matter of general tendencies more than an either-or thing. And 1960 is sometimes a handy point to touch in this, but it shouldn't be taken too literally. And I didn't mean to imply ever that I thought that as of about 1960 that Mormonism was about to be swallowed up entirely as part of the American culture, but only that along in there somewhere Mormons and especially their leaders began to become uneasy about the amount of assimilation they thought they saw or felt. It's almost even beside the point whether the degree of assimilation was, as an empirical reality, very great. Because my argument is more that it was what was perceived as a danger or a problem for the church leaders. To the extent that church leaders were fearful that assimilation might take place or might go too far, was a sufficient explanation for the retrenchment motif that I've argued for. So let's not take all of that too literally. I was somewhat surprised that all three of my colleagues had comments to make about the ethnicity question. As David pointed out, that's really a relatively small part of the book. And I brought it up only because I thought that it was that this tendency to start talking in ethnic terms about Mormons was just one of a number of expressions of the effort to recover a sense of lost Mormon identity. It was just kind of one symptom of that. Whether or not the Mormons are an ethnic group is, first of all, strictly a matter of definition. What you think an ethnic group is. And the definition of ethnic group is all over the map. All you have to do is go to any encyclopedia or anthropological reference book and you get a whole range. So pick your definition of ethnic group, and if you think the Mormons are an ethnic group, that's fine with me. What I think is a lot more interesting, as Kendall pointed out, is what uses do we make of this concept of ethnic group? I mean, what difference does it make whether you say Mormons are an ethnic group or something else? What do you do with that idea? To what uses is that concept put? So I don't want to argue with anybody about whether Mormons are really an ethnic group anymore. Just about the last thing David said was, I thought, implicit, or at least was very close to what I was trying to say, that the assertion of Mormon ethnicity comes precisely at the time, and I would say because of, the weakened sense of traditional Mormon identity from other traditional measures. So that makes perfectly good sense to me. Well, again, I won't say any more about that. I take seriously the weaknesses that were pointed out, especially some things like Jan's point about the ambiguity and what level I'm talking about when I talk about assimilation. That probably, if I were to do any rewriting of this, should require some more precision. I think in a sense that the two kinds of assimilation are related. That is, whether we're talking about assimilation going on within the church or the church's assimilation to the society, I think they're related processes because as the church begins to assimilate to the society, society creeps into the church. And so it takes place in both levels. So with that, I'll stop and again thank my colleagues for their generous comments, and I'll turn the time back to Ken answer any hands that might come up. Thank you again. Ken, you want to take over again? Well, sure. Obviously, it depends on what you want for the church. To the extent that you sense a note of approbation, I think all it is, or certainly all I intended, was that as a social scientist familiar with long-standing theory about social movements and how they survive, I think that this process of retrenchment in the face of the threat of assimilation is just the right thing to do organizationally. If what you want for the church is its survival and its continued growth, why, that's just the right thing to do, according not only what I would like, but according to what I would derive from existing social science theory about movements. All the experts, if they were called in for consultation, would say, what you got to do now is some retrenchment, maybe, if you've gone too far. So if from that point of view, I think it's fine. I certainly don't personally feel good about all of the manifestations of this retrenchment. They bother me a great deal, especially the fundamentalism. And while I think my colleagues got clear the distinction between the official and the folk levels, I want to emphasize for this audience that the retrenchment I was talking about per se was primarily an official initiative. That there is a side effect of that at the folk level that is a lot less healthy. So I wouldn't want my book to be read as approving in some normative way of everything that goes with retrenchment. But theoretically, it's a sound thing to do if you want your movement to thrive. Oh, yeah. Right. In that connection, my colleagues did not emphasize nearly as much as I thought they should have the synthesis that I tried to make between the classical church sect theory and the more recent theory in the sociology of religion, which originates with my colleague Rodney Stark and some of his colleagues who've used the market metaphor in precisely this way, that you got to have a product that fills a niche, and this product has to make demands on people so that it appears to be worthy of the price that they have to that is paid, and there have to be some kinds of rewards for the prices that they pay. As far as assimilation is concerned, oh yeah, there are a lot of religious movements that have died out, and through some kind of assimilation, there's some. I think it's probably more interesting to see some that are in the process of dying out. For example, the Unitarians. The Universalists are, for all practical purposes, gone. They merged with the Unitarians. For all practical purposes, again, the Congregationalists now merged as United Church of Christ with the UCC is a merger of Congregationalists and who else? An old Christian church, it was called. Right, and that's what you see. You know, that's where this general line of theorizing comes from. The less demanding a religion is on its people, the less it thrives. It tends to start dying out, and its products come to be less valued. So it's a fairly common thing. A lot of talk in mainstream Protestantism these days among intellectuals and theologians about, what's happened to mainstream Christianity and what can we do to bring it back. Anything else? Gosh, is that all? Okay, well, buy the book. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Armand, and I would endorse that. I don't know about buying the book. Read the book, anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.